Hey, it's Shauna Meyerson with Yoga Athletica in Los Angeles, California, here today with Shabbos Kastenbaum on the Yoga of War podcast. On October 7th, 2023, thousands of marauding terrorists flooded into Israel, barbarically slaughtering, burning, dismembering, raping, beheading, and kidnapping innocent Israelis, mostly Jews, mostly peace activists. Hours later, and before the blood of the victims was even dry, 31 Harvard student and faculty groups representing over 1,000 members issued a joint statement condemning not Hamas, but Israel for the attacks on its own citizens. Listen, there isn't a single person on earth who's been paying attention the last few decades who didn't predict that the world would turn on Israel and the Jews as soon as the IDF responded to the Hamas atrocities. But there also isn't a single one who predicted the world would turn on the victims of the bloodiest massacre in Western civilization, even as the Hamas rampage was literally still in progress. The once illustrious Crimson Campus quickly descended into a severely hostile cesspool of festering anti-Semitism, where amidst genocidal chants and mass pro-terror demonstrations, Jewish students and faculty now felt ostracized, intimidated, and threatened. Graduate student Shabbos Kastenbaum led the call for university action and protection. And all the administration could say was it depends on the context. Today, Shabbos and five other unnamed co-defendants are suing Harvard for its gross violations of Title VI civil rights protections. Jewish civil rights are civil rights, and Shabbos is one of the nation's young leaders leading the fight for justice. Shabbos Kestenbaum is a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, where he researched the intersections between public policy and contemporary Jewish life in the United States. He has testified before Congress and is the lead plaintiff against Harvard University, alleging pervasive and systematic anti-Semitism. To quote Shabbos's words, "I hope to be remembered as someone who stood up for their values and fought for the Jewish people in all the ways I could, for as long as I could, wherever I could." Thank you so much, Shabbos, for joining me. It is such an honor to have you, even as more than a year later, 101 hostages still remain in brutal Hamas captivity.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here. And yes, it's a shame that 1 year after the fact, we still have to have these conversations. But unfortunately, they are needed now, perhaps more than ever.
Exactly. And ultimately, this is a conversation that should not have to be had. It's simply a matter of common decency and morality. But alas, can we start by going back 1 year? What happened at Harvard, literally on October 7th and on October 8th? Can you bring us back to that moment?
Sure. So people often ask me what was anti-Semitism like at Harvard post October 7th, and that really does a disservice to the inexcusable behavior of our classmates, our peers, and yes, our professors. So I was at Harvard Chabad, which is the main institution of Jewish life on campus, and there were rumors that there was a terrorist attack. It was a bombing. No, it was a stabbing. You know, the reality is in the state of Israel in the 21st century, there is terrorism. I lived in the old city of Jerusalem for 2.5 years, and there was a 12-year-old boy who lived two doors down from me who was stabbed. It happens. We don't like it, but it's sort of par for the course, unfortunately. So we didn't think much of it. As the night went on, the rumors persisted and the rumors were strengthened, and it became very clear that what was happening was something that I, as a young person, had never experienced before in my life, which is Israel as an existential issue. And although I'm Orthodox, meaning I don't use my phone or any electronics on the Sabbath or Jewish holidays, I began to try to call my loved ones in Israel. I have three siblings, two in-laws, a nephew, two nephews, a grandparent, cousins, and as I was doing that, as dozens of Jewish students at Harvard University were doing that, we had our classmates who saw the images of women bleeding from their private areas, who saw the images of babies crying as they're being cordoned onto motorcycles taken into Gaza, who saw the images of burnt bodies in these destroyed cars. And their immediate reaction, these are 34 student groups representing more than 1,000 students, their immediate reaction was to jump out of bed, some still in their pajamas, to draft what they called an emergency statement to blame Jews for the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. You know, the opening of their statement literally reads, "We hold the Israeli regime entirely responsible for all unfolding violence in the Middle East." No mention or condemnation of Hamas. And in fact, in the Harvard Divinity School WhatsApp group, where all the students, a student had posted a picture for a rally they were organizing called "Long Live the Resistance, Victory is Ours." This is the night of October 7th. And the response from my classmates and peers was as if this student was planning a picnic. You know, is this open to the public? Can I help make signs? And it became quite clear, you know, literally that night, that we Jewish students were not only defending or had to defend the state of Israel, but also our right as Jews to be on campus. And that ushered in an almost unbelievable, I say unbelievable because had I not been a student at Harvard and witnessed these things, I would have said that there's no way this could have happened. But an unbelievable onslaught of anti-Semitism at America's most prestigious and oldest university. We had an Israeli student told by her professor to leave the class because her nationality made others uncomfortable. We had an Israeli student being physically accosted at the business school. We had a Jewish student spat on for wearing a kippah. A staff member at Harvard taunted me with a machete and destroyed all of our hostage posters. We've had just last week, the Palestine Solidarity Committee called for an escalation and to bring the war home. Windows were smashed on campus. Red fake blood was poured on the John Harvard statue. And it only escalates. It only has escalated. And as I said in the beginning, I'm sorry we're talking. I'm sorry a year after we still have these issues, but I don't see it getting any better, which really underscores why our lawsuit and building a coalition of young American Jews and the American people to repudiate the Ivy Leagues is so critical.
I agree. And also, I just want to reiterate for anyone who did not catch it, Shabbos was a graduate student at the Harvard Divinity School. Mm-hmm. You sort of expect more from people who tether themselves to God. And it's not just the glaringly offensive and anti-Semitic double standards, but like the timing in the wake of the great awakening of Black squares filling social media and the DEI revolution and exhaustive sensitivity training, the absurdity of blaming Israel for being the victims of the most savage terror attack the human mind could possibly even conceive is only compounded by the absurdity of blaming the Harvard Jewish community for the war on Hamas. Like, how do you even make sense of this? How is this at all possible?
Yeah, so you really underscored the dilemma quite well, whereby I was at an institution, not just that is allegedly prestigious, but particularly at a school that is involved in the pursuit of theology and divinity. And it was that school, the Harvard Divinity School, that I would argue was really ground zero for this anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, anti-West, and certainly anti-Semitic discourse and behavior. So much of it, I believe, comes from this false sense of justice and this false sense of morality, where I'm sure you and your listeners have heard of this stereotype before, but it's actually quite accurate that diversity, equity, and inclusion builds two categories of peoples, the oppressor and the oppressed. And American Jewry has the misfortune under this rubric of being mischaracterized as white. So whether it was 40 babies or 40,000 babies who were beheaded on October 7th, it really doesn't matter because, as my classmates will tell you, resistance is justified when people are occupied. And that really animated this oppressor-oppressed narrative and dynamic. It really animated so much of the hate and the onslaught that we saw immediately, not a week after, not in response to Israel's ground invasion of Gaza, but that night, people cheering on the resistance, people cheering on the murder, raping, and kidnapping of Jewish people. So before I came into Harvard, and I would imagine, like most Americans, I sort of had this illusion or this fantasy that Harvard is really the not just most intellectually advanced institution, but morally upright, that really sets the ethical barometers for our country. And then once you sort of go into the Ivy League bubble, you realize that it's a lot of fluff and there's not much substance and there's certainly not much morality that's tethering these curriculum, these professors, these students in morality, in ethics, in justice. And that's why we saw such a profound level of animosity towards innocent Jewish victims.
Yeah, it truly is astounding. I mean, I read most, I couldn't get through all of the 77-page complaint yet, but it's jaw-dropping. It's really jaw-dropping how packed this is with smoking gun evidence and what a horrific indictment it is on Harvard and its inaction. Let's talk about Title VII. And before I do, like, honestly, I can't help but draw this parallel. Like, on October 6th, right, there was a ceasefire in place. Israel just wants peace. I don't care what anybody says. Look through history. Israel just wants peace. On the 7th, thousands of Hamas terrorists invade Israel in a grotesque and bloodthirsty rampage. Israel didn't start this war. They didn't and don't want this war, but they will win this war. And here you are. You're fighting on the 8th front, right? The war of words and lawfare. You're a theology student at one of the world's top institutions. You just wanted an education. On October 8th, over 1,000 of Harvard terrorist sympathizers began their vicious attacks on the Jewish community. You did what you could. You didn't start this conflict. You didn't and don't want to sue Harvard, but you will win this suit. Can you broadly explain to the viewers Title VI? And I know there's 77 pages of evidence, but how Harvard has blatantly, you've given some specific instances, but how they have blatantly violated Title VI itself.
Sure. So, you know, the good news / bad news is we actually have an amended complaint. So the original lawsuit was 77 pages. Now I think it's double in length. So I encourage your listeners, they can just Google Keston M. Harvard lawsuit. They could read it themselves. But yes, it is quite lengthy now, unfortunately. So Title VI is a provision of the Civil Rights Act that prohibits public institutions, certainly ones that receive federal dollars, from discrimination based on three categories. Religion is not a protected category. It never was. President Trump in 2018 or 2019, reclassified the federal definition of Judaism under the law. So Judaism, in the eyes of the federal government, is no longer just a religion, but it is also an ethnicity, which is actually true. I mean, Judaism is not just a religion. We're a people. We have shared ancestry. And because we are now deemed an ethnicity, we are now protected under the National Origin Clause of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which is why you have seen sort of an explosion of these Jewish-led lawsuits against their universities, because for the first time, we are actually protected with these federal rules and regulations. So the bulk of our lawsuit, again, I encourage everyone to read it, but the bulk of it pertains to Title VI violations. So Harvard has an obligation to treat its students, Jewish and non, white and black, Christian, Muslim, it doesn't really matter, but they have an obligation to treat their students in a non-discriminatory way and in a non-discriminatory fashion. And we are alleging that due to our national origin status, due to our identity as Jews, we have been treated in a different manner than every other student and every other student or ethnic group on campus. So again, I can give you that laundry list of incidents, but there's really one that pops into my head. And the reason I'm using this one is because it was my first experience of anti-Semitism. And that was my first month of being a Harvard student. So the Harvard-Palestine Solidarity Committee invited to campus for the third time, Muhammad Al-Kurd. Muhammad Al-Kurd is someone who professes that Jews eat the organs of Palestinians, that the Israeli occupying forces have internalized the ways of Nazi Germany, that we have to normalize massacres. He lamented how sad it is that Palestinians can no longer hijack planes. You know, this is a guy who appeared on the Anti-Defamation League's top 10 anti-Semites, which is a pretty impressive list to be on. And we went to the university and said, you have a strong track record of disciplining speech you don't like. Whether that's right or wrong, that's what the university has always done. So the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expressions, FIRE, they ranked 248 American universities as to how well they protect the First Amendment, how committed they are to free speech. And Harvard was ranked 248th. This is a university that routinely rescinds the invitations of controversial speakers. This is a university that unaccepted about a dozen students who had posted sexist memes in a private WhatsApp group. So we said, look, just treat Jewish students the same way you treat all other minority students and don't have such a blatant anti-Semite come to campus. And Harvard shrugged their shoulders and said, well, he has a First Amendment right, and what do you want us to do about it? And, you know, that would be a great answer if that's what historically they've always answered, but they never answer other student groups like that. So that is a blatant double standard that is obviously discriminatory. And as we will prove in court, it's illegal. And I just want to add, what a damning indictment on the state of higher education in the United States, that in order for Jewish people to receive equity, justice, equality, we have to resort to a court of law. You know, we should not be suing our own university for our federal rights. But Harvard have insisted since day one that they will not work with us. They will not work to create a more equitable space for Jewish students. And in fact, when we filed the lawsuit, which was mid-January, Harvard's response was to file a motion to dismiss with prejudice, meaning they were asking a judge not only to toss out our lawsuit, but to make it clear that no other Jewish student would ever be able to hold their school accountable for anti-Semitism. And when we filed that amended complaint that I was alluding to, the more than 100 pages lawsuit, they did the exact same thing. No apology, no remorse, no trying to negotiate, but just telling the judge, throw this out. So I'm very proud to say that we are the first case in American history pertaining to the civil rights violations of Jewish students that's actually going to trial. This has never happened before. Either the cases are dismissed outright or they're settled, but we are going all the way to the courts, and we will be victorious because the facts are on our side, and we have nothing to apologize or be fearful of.
100%. The legal precedent will definitely not only go down in history, but in our very short-term history, I see a whole domino of universities that are about to fall. And also, I just, as a human being, want to say that regardless of whether Jews fall under Title VI or not, again, common decency. I don't care if it's people marching for the death of all white men who definitely are not covered under Title VI. Common decency and morality says that this kind of behavior, legal or illegal, is not acceptable, and particularly in our institutions of higher learning.
Yeah, I think the point we're trying to make is that Jewish students are not really asking for special treatment under the law. We're asking for equal treatment under the law. We're asking that the law protect us in the way that it protects other students. And correct, this is not simply a Jewish issue or an issue of anti-Semitism, but as you quite rightly pointed out, it's of human decency. It's a basic morality. When you have a minority group, whether it's Jewish or Christian, whether it's a black person or a white person, we stand up because it's the right thing to do. You know, I, without wading into politics too much, but I was, or still sort of am, a progressive. I marched for Black Lives Matter. I marched at the Supreme Court when Roe v. Wade was overturned. I think the denial of rights to a given group is a threat to all groups everywhere, which is to sort of paraphrase MLK. And what we were really disgusted and horrified with was that lack of sensitivity and that lack of solidarity when Jewish lives were at stake and were involved. So.
That's right. So let me ask, because I know your time is so limited. So the plaintiffs who are unnamed are calling themselves Students Against Anti-Semitism. And then there's you, the named. So what is Students Against Anti-Semitism's goal for this lawsuit? Like, what's the intended outcome? I know that I do want to mention, because it very much is sort of like a pink elephant in the room, that there is, of course, going to be a financial component to this. Nonetheless, Harvard has over $50 billion in endowment. So I sort of question if there's any leverage in any sort of like financial restitution. But likewise, given the congressional hearings, if Congress actually does at some point pull funding, I have a weird question. Will that suddenly make Harvard immune from Title VI prohibition? So could we wind up in this weird backward loop that our very efforts to seek justice creates exactly the opposite.
Sure, not a weird question at all. Harvard and all these institutions and universities will be held accountable for Title VI violations, whether it's through the private courts or whether it's through the Department of Education and the Office of Civil Rights. That is something, regardless of any lawsuit, they have to do. And in fact, the Department of Education really should have been on top of these things to begin with, but they have cases sitting on their desks dating back from as early as 2011. They're very, very slow at investigating and prosecuting these crimes. And to date, there has never been a professor who was disciplined or expelled as a result of an Office of Civil Rights investigation, but I digress. So the Students Against Antisemitism, which is the corporation, but really nonprofit that we established, really seeks to, as the name suggests, stomp out antisemitism within institutions of higher learning. So there are basic things that we're asking for in our lawsuit, things like tuition reimbursements. Why should we spend money for an institution that repeatedly stabs Jews in the back? We wanted to come to Harvard for an educational experience, and it is objectively the case that we have had diminished educational opportunities. We want Harvard on the more large scale to rescind the hundreds of millions of dollars they receive annually from anti-democratic, anti-Western, and anti-Semitic countries like Qatar, Russia, China, Saudi Arabia. We want there to be a zero tolerance policy for anti-Semitism in the same way there already is for other forms of discrimination. We want there to be things like mandatory Title IX training, which again is something that's already mandated for students. It just doesn't include anti-Semitism. And more fundamentally, we want the articulation and the enforcement of policies to make sure that no student, and again, I'm going to sound like a broken record, whether you're Jewish or Muslim, whether you're black or white, whether you're wealthy or poor, no student should have to go through what I and the five other plaintiffs in the lawsuit had to go through. And it's not asking for too much. And then broadly speaking, there is a push outside of our lawsuit, just a push that we're trying to create in the public narrative and in the public setting, which is, well, hang on a second. If Harvard University, if Columbia, if Penn, if MIT, if they are reneging on their obligations under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, then why should they also in the same breath be entitled to privileges, namely money from the federal government? Why is it that Harvard alone receives roughly $700 million a year from the federal government and at the same time violate federal law? So we are trying to use this as leverage. We are trying to get Congress to really close the faucets here, because they are guzzling billions of dollars to these institutions every year, and it's not in the interest of the American taxpayer anymore. And I do think that should the United States Congress do that, that will create a ripple effect. I think that will send a jolt into the system, sort of like an electric shock that wakes up Harvard and forces them, capitulates them into change, into really creating the impact that students have been asking for them to do for a while now.
So, yeah, I guess like what is difficult to wrap my head around a little bit is, as absolutely necessary as this lawsuit is at this time, sadly, we can't like outlaw hate. So let's say the campuses do everything they need to do to stop the intimidation, the discrimination against the Jewish community. The government calls in the National Guard and all the anti-Semitic demonstrations are shut down. The masks are banned, arrests are made. Everybody is fired, expelled, suspended. We're only treating the symptoms and not the cause. And these students, even if suppressed, are still, like you, our next generation of leaders, educators, and parents. And that's what worries me. We could hide it, we could mask it, we could slap as much lipstick as we want on this pig. The state of hate, I think, is the real issue. May I ask, though, from your experience, like, what was the general reaction of the Harvard community to what was going on? I mean, do you feel like most students were on board? Most students are with the Jews. Most students don't care, and faculty as well. Like what was the Harvard not the administration, the community reaction to everything that's gone on this past year?
Sure. So first, let me just address your first point, which I totally agree with. You're not going to legislate away the ideology of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a virus of the mind, and unfortunately, it has been with the Jewish people for 3,000 years. In the same way that you are not going to legislate away racism, because again, unfortunately, racism will always exist, what you can do is erase the manifestation of racism. So yes, in people's hearts and minds, they still unfortunately may be racist, but they don't act upon their assumptions or narratives. They don't tell people, they don't tell African Americans to sit in the back of the bus. And if they did, guess what? Their ass would be thrown in jail that night. So what we are not asking for is not the suppression of ideas. I think the only way you combat bad ideas is with good ideas. But what we are asking for is the suppression of violence, the suppression of intimidation, the suppression of the breaking of rules and regulations of Harvard's own internal policies. So yes, it's not that we can legislate our way out of saying free Palestine and globalize the Intifada, because unfortunately, there will probably always be students who believe those things. What we can say is you can express your stupidity and your hate and your anti-Semitism, but the moment you block the entrance to the library, the moment you put your hands on a student, the moment you smash windows, which are all things that happened at Harvard University, then it doesn't become an anti-Semitism issue solely. It becomes an issue of safety. It becomes an issue of Western democracy and liberal values, and that is something we are not going to tolerate. And unfortunately, these universities are led by feckless individuals, so we have unfortunately tolerated. The inexcusable has become excusable. And in terms of the second part of the question, which is really, you know, what has the reaction been of Harvard, not the Jewish community, not the anti-Israel activists? It's difficult for me to quantify. I just don't know. What I will say is I don't even want to say majority, but there's a significant amount. I don't know how many, but there's a significant amount of Harvard students who see the encampments, who see their classrooms being interrupted, who see loud demonstrations when they're trying to sleep or study for finals. And they don't like that behavior. They don't like those actions. They don't support this inability to come to terms with protesters who don't see that actions have consequences. In fact, one of the leading articles in the Harvard Crimson this week, which is the student newspaper, is there seems to be a Palestinian exception to consequences, whereby the Palestinian leadership, the student groups on campus, they want maximum disruption with minimal discipline. And that's not really how being a student or being an individual in a civil society really works. You know, MLK and Gandhi, who they often compare themselves to, they got arrested. They dealt with the punishments. They knew what they were getting themselves into. They weren't wearing masks to conceal their identity. They weren't claiming unfairness when they were arrested. That was part and part of what they were doing. So I do think there's a significant amount of the Harvard population that do not support these individuals. But again, it's hard to quantify. What we do know is just looking at the data, unfortunately, of the 13 schools at Harvard, four of them, the Divinity School, the Graduate School of Design, the Medical School, and the Law School, they passed boycott divestment resolutions, BDS resolutions, as a response to October 7th. So that's certainly concerning.
Yeah, it's all certainly concerning. I know that you're out of time, so let me just ask one more question because
I can do a 10 more minutes if that's okay. If not, no worries. But yeah, I'm happy. I'll be late to my next meeting. It's fine.
Perfect. I'll take it. Thank you so much, Chavez. I hope it's not Trump again.
It's not. We're good. I could be late to this one.
Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. So let's talk a little bit of like sort of the, you know, hand in hand sister, you know, project of Title VI, which would be the DEI system, which is clearly broken. I think Harvard explains this 1,000 different ways in just two words, Claudine Gay. What is the solution? Like, so do we fold Jews into the equation or do we dismantle it completely? And if we dismantle it, and it's just like the same question with Hamas, we create a vacuum. So what's going to replace it? Because we're not going to get rid of, you know, civil rights advocacy on campus and protections. So there has to be something in place. It can't be what's currently in place. When I look at like ethnic studies curricula, and I've only really, really looked deeply into the ones here in California, but they are vastly anti-Semitic, deeply anti-Israel. And so we get rid of DEI. We have the whole education system that is pushing these kids into the anti-Israel, into the anti-Semitic camps and narratives. So what comes next?
Yeah, that's a question I get a lot. What it really boils down to, DEI, amend or end. And in the beginning, I was on the amend side of the equation. I thought that there are ways that we can fix it. We can evolve it into a system that actually does champion equity for all peoples. The problem is, if you leave out the anti-Semitism just for the sake of argument, all data on DEI really reports the same thing, which is that if its intended goal and purpose is to create more diverse and equitable spaces, whether it's in the classroom or in a business meeting, the employer, the employee, and the students or professors, they actually report the exact opposite, that they become more uncomfortable. They become more hesitant to talk about these issues. When you look and judge someone solely through the prism of race, religion, or ethnicity, it does not create those diverse and equitable spaces that DEI seeks to champion. So it's actually a self-serving prophecy of doom, sort of a death spiral that feeds off of its own demise. So even if you believe in those virtues, the DEI model is actually not how you reach it, because objectively, it just doesn't work. And now you add in the anti-Semitism equation, which we've really seen from the last year. Jews and Judaism was never taken into consideration through these DEI models, because, as I mentioned earlier, we're really viewed through the prism of white colonialism or of white privilege. And Jews kind of break this mold of DEI for two reasons. One, we're not all white. And number two, traditionally, the model of DEI is, if you have been oppressed, if you have been victimized, if you have been persecuted in some way or another, you can never be successful on your own. You need these artificial policies, or you need a leg up from a foreign source, some form or another. And the problem is, Jews have been historically marginalized and oppressed and persecuted, but we're also quite successful on our own. So we don't even fit that model to begin with. So my take has really been that these systems, diversity, equity, and inclusion, while well-meaning and well-intended, you know, as I said, I'm a progressive. I certainly believe in elevating the voices of the marginalized, but DEI is not how you do it. So we have to get rid of it. Certainly federal government should not be funding this in any way. But to your point of, okay, you got rid of DEI. Now what's the replacement? This might be a controversial take. I actually don't think you need a replacement. I think if you made educational institutions about education once again, if you made the most important virtue of an institution of higher learning about intellectual diversity, then I think that would probably be best for our college campuses. You know, Morgan Freeman has a controversial take, which I don't actually agree with, but he says, you know, how do you end racism? Stop talking about it. Stop having Black History Month, because every month should be Black History. And again, that's not my idea. That's Morgan Freeman's. But I think he has a point there, where if you create these artificial, superficial, or forced conversations, it's never going to lead to your desired outcomes. It just isn't. So I do think we should end it and replace it with a focus not on race, ethnicity, or religion, but intellectual diversity, intellectual openness, because that's ultimately what an institution of higher learning is meant to be about anyway.
Sure. And Coleman Hughes actually started with exactly that same statement, is that we're propagating racism by focusing so intently on it. And so let me talk about because you're very unique. I know you just sort of touched upon it, but that in this world of the Jacksonists, you are, as you sort of term, like the only Orthodox person who is a, you know, progressive Democrat. I know that you now famously are helping to stump for Trump for reasons having to do with Israel and anti-Semitism and the Democrats largely turning their backs on the Jews. Now, in contrast, because you have not rescinded your club membership in the Democratic Party, you do maintain that hope. I want to, having nothing to do with politics, I want to contrast that to Rabbi Wolpe, who famously left the Harvard Anti-Semitism Task Force because it was a lost cause. So there's always this question of, like, Brett Stevens at the New York Times is another example. It's like, do you fight from within or do you fight from without? For example, if Ackerman took his money and instead of pulling it, said, I'm going to give you this endowment for a pro-Israel center on campus, I get to choose who the faculty members are, and therefore we're getting to the root cause. Now, I'm not saying, I actually agree with what he did pulling the funding. But there's always this question of, is it better to try to create a change from within the group that you already belong to, or because they turn your back, their back on you, you turn your back on them, and it's sort of nah, 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 what's next?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of important points there. Number one is Rabbi Wolpe, who was my professor and a role model of mine, he left because, as you said, he really thought that it was irredeemable, the anti-Semitism task force, and it couldn't accomplish the stated purpose. I agree with him, and that was the right thing to do. I agree that the task force was an irredeemable endeavor. I don't have the same conclusion when it comes to the Democratic Party just yet. Once I come to that conclusion that it's irredeemable, that we cannot fix this, then yes, I will leave. I'm not naive enough to suggest that that could never happen. But at this moment in time, in October of 2024, I do think there's enough ammunition within the Democratic Party that we really could reform some of the more anti-Israel, anti-American values within the party. But as I said, if that fight is lost, then yes, I wouldn't stay. So as it pertains to, you know, Bill Ackman, and just in general, should we be funding the universities so that we can fight back, so that there can be an Israel study center or whatever it is? The assumption in that question is that institutions like Harvard are worthy enough or are redeemable enough that we should be planting our money because those spaces are important enough. I'm making the argument that Jew or non-Jew, the American people are looking at college campuses or specific college campuses, and they are repudiating these Ivy League values, and they're migrating to places like Texas A&M, the University of Miami, Georgia Tech. And it is a good thing that Harvard has a 17% drop in early applications. It's a good thing that they have a 5% drop in applications overall. It's a good thing that they've had $1 billion withheld, because right now the assumption is that Harvard is the public marketplace of ideas. And I'm trying to make that case that we should actually migrate elsewhere. We should move that public marketplace somewhere else. And just like how cryptocurrency is valued based on what the subjective collective desires of a populace are, I think Harvard and the Ivy Leagues are subjectively given a lot more value than is warranted. And if we were to divert that worth and to divert that value elsewhere, we would be better off as a result. And I'll just add one last point as someone who grew up as an Orthodox Jew who lives in the Jewish community. You know, if you're a donor like Bill Ackman, I mean, I don't mean Bill Ackman himself, but someone with a significant amount of money, give that money to Jewish day schools. Give it to Jewish summer camps. Give it to places that can give Jewish people an education. That's how you'll really fight and combat anti-Semitism, when you have proud, knowledgeable, educated Jewish people as young and as early as possible.
Yeah. Let me just go on record as my personal prophecy that within the next 5 years, Yeshiva University is going to be a top 10 school in America, because all the top Jewish kids, all the top Jewish faculty are going to go there. They're already a great school. It will be interesting to see how things shift over the years, because there's still something to be said for what's in a name, the value of a name. I have four kids, nephews three who started college this year. And when weighing the name of the school with the anti-Semitism at the school, ultimately, I think a lot of kids are still like going for the name, unfortunately. So I do hope it turns. I know you got to go. So thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Looking for the silver lining here. Has the anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, anti-Semitic movement significantly galvanized the Jewish community at Harvard? Do you feel like ultimately the Jewish community has somehow benefited from this backlash?
Yeah, I think that's actually a great note to end off on, because it's sort of my whole, what's the right word? It's kind of my message to young people. I'm fellow young people. So there's, of course, the famous line from Charles Dickens, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. You don't need me to reiterate why it's the worst of times. It's relatively self-evident, but it's the best of times because yes, the unity within the Jewish community, not just at Harvard and not just on college campuses, but the unity within American Jewry has really, really solidified our values, have really solidified our sense of community and belonging. And it is a shame that it took the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, of course, for that to happen. But if you look at Harvard University just last week, when they had a commemoration for October 7th, you had the overwhelming majority of the Jewish community show up with Israeli flags, with candles, with prayer books, you know, listening to Rabbi Hershey Zarchi of Harvard Chabad, listening to Rabbi Rubenstein of Harvard Hillel. And yes, there are those within the community who dissent. Unfortunately, there are some in the community who were student encampment leaders, but they represent a minority. They are a fringe radical subset of the Jewish community who never had a desire to be part of the community to begin with. The overwhelming majority of young American Jews are united and unified in the goal of exploring and pursuing Jewish identity, Jewish values. We have never felt more attached and connected to the land of Israel. And yes, we will continue to question and critique, and certainly the criticism of Israeli policy is not anti-Semitic. It's something we do as a national pastime. But our unwavering spirit to the Jewish state, as the national anthem states, you know, lo avda tikvatenu, our hope is not yet lost. There is always a brighter day and a brighter future ahead. And we young people are so excited and enthusiastic to be part of that brighter day and brighter future.
Yeah, when it comes to Hatikvah, the hope, Shabbos, it's people like you that keep us afloat. I really appreciate not just you coming on the show. I appreciate everything you are doing for not even just the kids in America, but really for the whole world Jewish community. You are changing the world. I put all the contacts where people can find you. Also, a link to the 77 pager. I'll have to find the other one in the show notes. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we finish off?
Yeah, I'll add two things. One, we didn't talk about yoga, and I just wanted to say my dad, he does yoga every day, and I went to a yoga summer camp when I was like 10 or 11 years old called Camp Namaste in Teaneck, New Jersey. So that's my shout out to yoga. And the second thing I wanted to say is I of course spoke at the Republican convention. At the time, I didn't endorse Trump. I endorsed him 2 months later, but I wasn't actually there for a political speech, even though of course it's quite politically infused anyways. What I do want to say is there's an important election coming up. And yes, I've been very clear about who I'm supporting and why, but I want to add, if people disagree, that's great. That's good. It is healthy for our democracy, and it's healthy for the Jewish community to disagree with each other. I would just add that unity does not mean disagreements don't exist. Unity means that we can disagree with each other openly and publicly, but still call ourselves family, still say that we're part of the same team, because we all want the same thing. We want campus anti-Semitism to be eradicated. We want the safe and immediate return of our hostages. We want Israel to be strong and secure in its position in the Middle East. We just disagree on the conclusions as to how best to get there. But ultimately, we in the American Jewish community, we have the same goals. And while, yes, I will probably be voting in a way that the majority of American Jewry doesn't vote, which is a shame, but okay. But at the end of the day, what unites us is so much stronger than what divides us. And whatever happens this November, we should keep that sense of unity, keep that sense of camaraderie. And through that, we will be better as a result. So thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And amen. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.